I call the meeting of the Water Division to order. A quorum is present at this point in time. First item we have on our agenda is approval of the minutes. I was wondering if anyone has had a chance to take a look at those to move their approval. Representative Pinesman.
I'll move the minutes.
Thank you. Representative Pinesman moves approval of the minutes. Is there any further discussion? Corrections? Hearing none, all in favor of approving minutes signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion is approved. Couple of things as we get going today. First of all, I want to welcome everyone back from a break and back into session. You will find in your packets several presentations and also a House research memo on how bills are going to be moved this year. If you have any questions on the House memo, please feel free to follow up with Patrick McCormick or the House staff. First thing that we're going to be hitting on then today will be the presentation on Minnesota's experience with PFAS. I know this is becoming a larger and larger issue across the state, so we've got the agencies all set to come before us and give us quite an in-depth presentation. What we'll be doing as we're going forward, as you have questions, please let me know. We're planning at this part will probably take about an hour or so is what we're figuring, and then maybe about a half hour or so for the second half on E. coli. But at the same time, if there's a lot of questions, we'll try to arrange presentations so that we can make sure we can get the questions all answered. Anything from the committee before we get started then? Hearing none, I'd like to call forward. We have people from the Minnesota Department of Health and from the Pollution Control Agency. I don't know who is going to start first. So if you'd like to come up, I believe it's going to be Mr. Kelly from the Department of Health, if you'd like to introduce yourself, and then we can start with the presentation.
I would. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is James Kelly. I am a manager in the Environmental Health Division at the Minnesota Department of Health, and I'm here with colleagues from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency to give you some background and fairly in-depth background on the issue of perfluorinated or polyfluorinated alkyl substances, affectionately known as PFAS from now on. And with me here is Catherine Neuschler. She's also a manager at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. We'll be taking over when I'm finished. So what are these chemicals? What are per- and polyfluoral alkyl substances? They are a very large class of chemicals, at least 4,000 separate chemicals that we know of so far. They have very unique properties based on their physical structure. Their backbone is a carbon-fluorine bond, which is a very, very strong chemical bond. It takes a lot of energy to create that bond. It takes a lot of energy to break that bond, and that'll become important a little bit later. They were manufactured and widely used, still widely used, in a range of consumer and industrial applications going all the way back to the 1940s and 50s. And because of their persistence and the strength of these chemicals, the bonds in these chemicals, and their ability to move around, they've been found globally in both remote settings in the Arctic and Antarctic, as well as urban settings. So virtually everywhere we've looked, we found these chemicals. Just kind of quickly, a little bit of introduction to the different members of this particular family of chemicals through this family tree. The first group I want to call your attention to are the perfluorinated chemicals, specifically perfluoroalkyl acids, further broken down into carboxylates and sulfonic acids. Those are kind of our legacy PFAS chemicals. Those are the ones that were first manufactured in the 40s and 50s for these industrial applications. We often call them legacy chemicals. They're the backbone of the family of chemicals that was used in a lot of different products, Scotchgard and Teflon and so forth. By and large, those chemicals have been phased out of production in the United States, although they're still made commercially in China for some applications. Next, I just want to mention the polyfluorinated chemicals. That's sort of the newer generations of PFAS-related chemicals that took the place of some of the perfluorinated chemicals, so that's kind of a little different chemical structure, but a large variety of different chemicals. And then the polyfluorinated chemicals, however, in some cases can break down into the perfluorinated chemicals. As they degrade in the environment, at least partially, they degrade down to that kind of core perfluorinated chemical, and so they can actually cause or create the levels of perfluorinated chemicals. And then there are also fluorinated polymers. They're even newer in terms of their uses in industry and applications. We're not sure yet in all cases whether their ability to break down into perfluorinated chemicals. It hasn't been studied greatly. They're fairly new in the marketplace, so we're not entirely sure how those are going to behave in the environment. many of these chemicals are used to make polymers, and Teflon is actually a polymer that used PFOA as one of the kind of backbone products in the creation of it. Now they use different and shorter chain chemicals. The perfluorinated chemicals were the ones that were directly manufactured for many, many decades that we're still dealing with, whereas the polyfluorinated chemicals are now what's being used in many of the consumer products, your stain repellents, your Gore-Tex clothing, food protective packaging, and so forth. So it's a rather complex family of chemicals with many different members, but all share that kind of carbon-fluorine bond as kind of their backbone. So in the environment, the chain length of these chemicals, that is how long, how many chemicals, how many carbon atoms make up the chain and the other constituents of the molecules help derive and decide how persistent and how mobile they are in the environment. The shorter chain chemicals such as PFBA, and you can see them on the left side of the slide, they tend to not bioaccumulate to any great extent. They're smaller molecules, so they're very mobile in the environment, but they tend not to accumulate in the body. The long chain PFCAs, those are more of our legacy chemicals, and they're much more accumulative in both people and organisms. They're a little bit less soluble. They don't move quite as easily through the environment, but once they do get into the environment, they can move and they can accumulate in animals and people. So just a little bit based on the size of the molecules can have some bearing on whether or not they move through the environment or they can accumulate in the body. So why has this been such an issue in Minnesota? Well, 3M's operates a chemical manufacturing plant in Cottage Grove, Minnesota, on the banks of the Mississippi River. In around the early 2000s, they first informed both the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency and the Department of Health that they had been manufacturing these chemicals here at their Cottage Grove facility. And then ultimately, the waste materials from the manufacture of these chemicals had been disposed of in several disposal sites farther north in Washington County. That's been the reason for the contamination that we found in the groundwater in the East Metro. Okay.
If we could pause there, I believe Representative Torkelson, you have a question or two.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I didn't know if you wanted to take questions during the presentation or
sure,
after.
Sure, go right ahead.
Just for my own education, when you talk about bioaccumulation, does that refer only to animals or plants and animals and soil profile? I just need to know.
Mr. Kelly.
Mr. Chair, Representative, it refers to accumulation within the bodies of organisms, so not typically plants, but animals. These chemicals have been found to accumulate in aquatic animals, in terrestrial animals, and in people. So it's not a concentration per se in the environment, but a concentration in living organisms.
But not plants.
Mr. Kelly.
Mr. Chair, Representative, not to any great extent in plants that we're aware of at this point.
Thank you.
One question I would ask is, while they're not found in plants, is there packaging material? They may be in packaging material, and then it gets transferred to the food in that kind of situation.
Mr. Chairman, yes, that has been a pathway that's shown that there can be some transfer from food food packaging into the food products themselves. That's one reason why we think that that we find these chemicals in the blood of virtually every American that we test. It's because of consumer products where these chemicals are used, such as food packaging and stain repellents and so forth.
Thank you, Mr. Kelly. And we have another question, Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I snuck ahead a little bit in your presentation to look because I'm curious about how, we have 3M on the presentation as a potential source for these chemicals and alongside the Mississippi, but we also know that we're permitting wastewater treatment facilities to process these chemicals and potentially discharge these chemicals through a dilution process back into the Mississippi far ahead of the 3M facility. So I'm assuming that would be somewhere in here, but I'm not seeing it. So did I miss it, or are we going to talk about that?
Mr. Kelly.
Mr. Chair, Representative, my colleagues from the Pollution Control Agency will be covering more of those elements as they get into other sources of these chemicals to the environment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah,
you're welcome. Any other questions at this point? Seeing none, Mr. Kelly, please go ahead and proceed.
So the disposal of these legacy PFAS chemicals in waste disposal sites in the East Metro were the cause of the groundwater contamination that we've found. When it was first discovered, Our two agencies worked to define the extent and the magnitude, really trying to understand where these chemicals are, how far they moved away from the manufacturing facility and the disposal sites. We sampled many, many public and private wells. We developed water guidance that I'll be talking a little bit more about to kind of set the parameters for how much exposure to these chemicals is allowable in groundwater and drinking water. Because at the time when this first came forward, very little was known about how effective home water treatment devices would be at removing them. We did a study that was funded by the legislature looking at a variety of home water treatment devices to be able to provide information to people who wanted to reduce their exposure. We did a study in garden produce in the East Metro because of that concerns about accumulation in plants. And while we found occasionally low levels, they weren't concentrating within the plants, but if they were watered recently with water that contained these chemicals, we could detect traces of them. We did a biomonitoring study, and I'll talk more about that in a little bit as well, as well as looking at various health outcomes in the East Metro population around cancer and birth outcomes. So in 2006, the issue really expanded in the East Metro when our laboratory added additional parameters to what they could test for in water samples, as well as lowered their detection limits. That virtually caused us to go from a plume that was relatively small of chemicals that were confined near the disposal sites overnight to an area that affected virtually all of South Washington County as we added these parameters and lowered the detection limits. So that really made that an issue for the entire Southeast Metro area, and one that we, again, worked with our colleagues at the MPCA to do public education and do all the sampling and do everything else that we've been engaged in since that time. So why are we concerned about these chemicals? I wanted to touch on that briefly as well. These chemicals are relatively new from a health study, a toxicological study standpoint, in that the first study started appearing in the scientific literature only in the kind of late 1990s, so that's a relatively short amount of time for an industrial family of chemicals. Animal studies, these are done in a very controlled manner where animals are exposed to a particular dosages of chemicals in order to observe the potential health effects, have shown the types of effects I have here on the slide, developmental effects, liver effects, effects on the kidney, some evidence of tumors from at least one of the chemicals. Now, when we look at human studies, these are studies that are done from an epidemiological standpoint. That is, they're done by observing populations who may have been exposed to these chemicals. Sometimes it's workers who are manufacturing them. Oftentimes it can be populations who are exposed through drinking water or some other manner where we know people have had elevated exposures to chemicals, and we try to follow them to see what effects they might have shown. There are some similar effects that have been suggested. Again, these are not cause and effect studies. They can't be linked conclusively that exposure to these chemicals causes these effects, but they're what we see as associations or possible links. But when we start to look at what we've seen in animal studies and what we see in the human epidemiological studies, we see some similarities in effects. Primarily developmental effects, effects on the liver, and potential effects on the immune system, meaning a potential for a decreased response to such things as vaccination. Those are some things that have been suggested in the literature, but they're very complex effects, and they're very hard to tease out, again, that cause and effect. But these tend to be the family of potential health concerns that we associate with perfluorinated and PFAS chemicals in general.
I do have one question, Mr. Kelly. As you're talking about the class of the chemicals, in your first when you first started, you said there were about 4,000 chemicals that fall under this category. Are all 4,000 have the same impact in these areas, or how does that break down? Because when I first hear 4,000, now I see the effects there. I need to know how large the scope is.
Mr. Chairman, the two most studied chemicals, the two most studied members of this family are PFOA and PFOS, and there's a handful of other chemicals that have been studied in depth, but the majority of them have not been studied in any great amount of depth, and we have to make assumptions based on what we know about their chemical structure, as well as how we think they're going to behave both in the environment and within the body to try to come to some generalized conclusions. But we think that these kinds of types of health effects are what we most expect to see from at least some of the members of this chemical family. There certainly could be others that just haven't been well studied yet.
Thank you. Another question, Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A number of these effects or possible concerns I've been aware of. The one that I haven't is this decreased vaccination response. Do you have that at hand, or is that something you could present, you could email me or help me access, look at?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, I can. There's been several studies done in both animals and in humans where they've observed those kinds of effects. As I said, they're not conclusive yet. There could be other causes behind them, but it has been something that's been observed, and I can certainly send you the studies.
Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you just expand a little bit on the identified potential issues or effects, as you just mentioned, relative to vaccination interactions?
Mr. Kelly.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, the particular study that looked at that looked at levels of perfluorinated chemicals that were measured in a group of children, I believe, in Europe, and then measured their response to it was either diphtheria or one of the kind of standard vaccinations. And their conclusions in the study were that the group that had higher levels of certain of these chemicals in the children's blood tended to have a lower response rate to the vaccine. So that you can measure the effectiveness of a vaccine in terms of the number of antibodies that the body produces in response to that, yeah, that challenge from the vaccine. And what they were observing or saying was that they felt that the response in the children with slightly higher levels of these chemicals was less than it was in a control population, so to speak.
Representative Torkelson.
Were you done?
No, I can get back to it.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. You said early in your testimony that these chemicals have been around since the 1940s and 50s, yet I've heard a number of times that they've not been well studied. Can you explain why it's taken so long to actually evaluate the effect of these chemicals?
Mr. Kelly.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the system that we have in this country that's the way the system is set up, chemicals are often introduced into the marketplace before they are studied extensively in terms of their potential to either move in the environment or their potential to impact human health or environmental health or organisms in the environment. The case of these chemicals, because they are so mobile and so persistent in the environment, means that they are able to travel great distances and be detectable most of the places we could find it. And that happened prior to them being really studied extensively from a health or an environmental standpoint. It was 3M studies in their workers that first showed that the chemicals were detected in the blood of their workers, and from there they started looking for control samples of blood where they could compare with what they were measuring in their populations. That led them to look at blood banks around the country. This was in the late 1990s. That was when the first indications were that no matter almost where they looked to look for clean or control samples of blood, they were finding these chemicals. And that really was, those findings were what started to prompt a lot of the studies that started going on at the federal level and among academics and industry.
Mr. Torkelson, Representative Torkelson.
I'm sorry to drag this on, but is that partly a result of our ability to detect them, or is it just our lack of concern?
Mr. Kelly.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the analytical methods have certainly changed dramatically over the years. I think it wasn't until around that same time period, the 1990s, where analyses could be done in water and certainly in blood that would be able to differentiate amongst these chemicals. So to some degree, yes, analytical capabilities were what allowed these to be detected more broadly than they probably could have been before.
Representative Heintzman, Torkelson. Representative Torkelson, any other questions?
Wait, thank you, Mr.
Okay, you're welcome. Thank you. Please continue.
So I wanted to touch a little bit on how the department goes about setting our safe thresholds for these contaminants in water. We take the types of animal studies that I alluded to previously, and we look for the effects that, we look for the dosages of the chemicals that cause a subtle or just a barely detectable effect in test animals. Then we identify the next lower dose, the dose that didn't cause that effect. And that, in fact, is then the basis for our guidance values that we set for people. We want to base those values on levels that don't cause health effects, not levels that do cause health effects. To that, we add margins of safety to account for the fact that people behave differently than animals. We're more complex organisms, typically, than the test animals. And we use that to define a reference exposure level. Then we allow a certain portion to come from drinking water. And that's how we end up developing these lifetime values for guidance values for levels of these chemicals in drinking water. They're intended to be very protective, intended under statute to be very protective. And we take that duty very seriously. So we've developed water guidance for formal water guidance for five members of this chemical, of this family of chemicals, typically the legacy chemicals that we see in the East Metro, but in other parts of the state as well. If you look at the table of values, they've evolved quite a bit over time. Our value for PFOA has gone from 7 parts per billion in 2002 to 0.035 parts per billion. That's 200-fold lower across the span of 17 years, and that reflects the growing needs of science. You'll also notice the two chemicals on the right, PFBA and PFBS, have much, much higher guidance values than PFOA, PFOS, and PFHXS. That's because of that bioaccumulation potential I talked about. They're shorter chain chemicals. They don't accumulate in the body to any great extent. Your body, they tend to move through your body relatively quickly, whereas PFOA and PFOS and PFHXS will hang around in your body for years. So our guidance values by statute are intended to protect the most vulnerable of populations. In this case, it's the developing fetus and breastfed infants who are born to mothers who have been exposed to these chemicals in their water for a relatively long period of time. That is the most vulnerable population because the chemicals pass through the placenta and are also present in breast milk. So that that means the developing fetus is the most vulnerable population that we need to protect. It's more protective. That may mean that it's overprotective or it provides greater protection for those who don't fall into those categories. We also look at the effects of these chemicals together because they do tend to affect the same organs. We don't want to look at them one by one. We want to look at them together because they usually appear in drinking water as combinations of chemicals, not one at a time. So we take that into account when we evaluate the health risk of exposure to these chemicals in water. So just contrast that, the EPA has issued guidance values for only two of these chemicals, PFOS and PFOA, of 0.07 parts per billion. So it's about double what our value is for PFOA and about 5 times what it is for PFOS. We're all, EPA and states are also looking at how we can look at these groups of chemicals more broadly as we start to see more of them in the environment as we do more testing for a wider variety of how we can do better risk assessment. I mentioned we did biomonitoring because these chemicals do accumulate in the blood of people. We did 3 rounds of biomonitoring in our East Metro populations that verified that as we started to take actions to reduce the levels of these chemicals in the drinking water of East Metro communities, primarily Oakdale, Lake Elmo, and Cottage Grove, the levels of these chemicals have declined in the bodies of those who participated in the studies over that time period. They still exceed the levels we see in the national population, which is the purple kind of block on the right side of each set of graphs. But they're headed in that direction, and that shows that when we can identify a source of exposure and take action to reduce it or eliminate it, levels in people's bodies will decline. These chemicals have represented a significant communication challenge over the years, as you might expect, because they're so widely detected in the environment, and our understanding has grown and changed significantly over the past 20 years. Our analytical abilities have evolved, meaning we can test them at ever lower amounts, ever lower levels, which makes it seem that they're being found more and more places when in reality they were probably there all along. And our risk assessment, as I said, has certainly changed over time. When our value for one of the chemicals is 200-fold lower than it was 17 years ago, that's a pretty significant change. So in ongoing activities, we continue to monitor systems in the East Metro and work with the Pollution Control Agency on the settlement, which I think you'll be hearing more about, and in the actions that will be taken in the East Metro. We continue to follow the science of these chemicals so that if there are significant new findings, we can take those into account in how we establish our guidance values. We've been sampling drinking water systems around the state. Bemidji has been a focus recently. To date, we've sampled 143 community public water systems for these chemicals around the state, and we have ongoing sampling going on in 13 systems, primarily in the East Metro, but also Bemidji and a few other locations as well. And we expect the EPA will be requiring a further analysis of public water supply systems around the state in what they call the unregulated contaminant monitoring rule, which is going to be coming up again in the coming year to 2 years. They're going to require, again, that all systems be monitored for an expanded list of PFAS chemicals and that smaller systems be monitored as well. So there'll be a lot more monitoring that will be going on. And we're also doing some additional targeted work looking at public water supply systems that could be near potential sources of PFAS to the environment. So we have a lot of work going on to monitor community water supplies across the state, and that work's going to continue and increase as we move ahead. I'm going to stop there and turn it over to my colleague from the MPCA, Catherine, and we can continue from there.
Why don't we pause for a second? Am I seeing indication from Representative Torkelson? You have some questions?
Well, thank you, Representative Fisher, Mr. Chair. Could you just talk a little more about our relationship with the federal government, with EPA, as far as how we set standards, how they set standards, how the one affects the other?
Mr. Chair, Representative, so the Environmental Protection Agency is not establishing any regulatory values for these chemicals. They've developed guidance values for just two of them, PFOS and PFOA. Their guidance values and our guidance values that we've developed here in Minnesota, as well as in many other states that have developed guidance values, are typically based on the same types of health studies, the same types of animal studies. We, however, took a much, we think, a more cautious approach in how we established those because of a particular statute that's called the Health Standards Statute from 2001 that requires us that when we do this type of work that we take directly into account our most vulnerable of populations. The EPA recognized that population is more vulnerable. They just didn't take it into account in a quantitative fashion in the way that we did. Other states are starting to look to the methods that we developed. We published them in the scientific literature and are starting to use those methods to more directly account for the exposure to the developing fetus. The EPA's values were based strictly on adult exposures.
First of all, any further questions, Representative Torkelson? Representative Sandell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you tell me what specific health impacts are a result of high or extensive impact of PFAS or PFOS in people of different ages, children, as opposed to older people, people who've been exposed for a short period of time or over a longer period of time? What do we expect in individuals' health?
Mr. Kelly.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we're looking for the types of health effects that I described earlier would be the types of things that would be focused on in terms of looking at a population of people. When people come to us and say, I've been exposed to these chemicals, I'm concerned about my health, we give them information that allows them to talk with their physicians about their exposures so that if they're at particular risk of liver disease, for instance, they can be monitored a bit more actively for those types of conditions. Typically, because the chemicals accumulate in your body over time, we tend to be more concerned about children and that levels because there's a longer period of time for those chemicals to build up. If you're exposed for a short amount of time or only exposed later on in life, the likelihood of potential health effects are much less. So really, that's why protecting children and especially the developing infant and developing fetus and very young infants is really critical here to prevent exposures from going on for the rest of their life.
Representative Sandell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I haven't heard people talk about this as being a carcinogen or causing problems with lungs or blood diseases. Has there been any connection between a high rate of PFAS in any of those illnesses or health problems?
Mr. Kelly.
Mr. Chair, Representative, there was a large health study that was done in the area of Ohio and West Virginia where a large population of about 70,000 people were exposed to primarily PFOA in their water supply. Through a settlement with DuPont, there was a health study done where they measured the level of these chemicals in the blood of 60,000 to 70,000 people and looked for evidence of health impacts. They did come up with a set of what they called probable links, and I use that term kind of loosely because it's more of a legal term than a medical term. They did find probable link between exposure to PFOA in drinking water and kidney and testicular cancer, preeclampsia, which is a kind of a condition of an expectant mother where their blood pressure can be out of balance, as well as several other related diseases. High cholesterol was one, again, because of the potential for liver impacts. That's really the best information we have of suggesting these impacts in humans, but there are many other things that can cause those conditions, so it's hard to say conclusively that they were only due to that exposure to PFOA.
Thank you.
Representative Sandell.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Flaflin.
Thank you, Chair, and Commissioner Kelly, on the page with the Minnesota Water Guidance, can you explain the difference between the health-based values and the health risk limits, please?
Mr. Kelly.
Mr. Chair, Representative, health-based values are the guidance values that we develop internally at the Department of Health. They follow the same or kind of a prescriptive set of rules that we develop them under that is done under the 1989 Groundwater Protection Act. Health-based values we issue, and then we periodically promulgate those as health risk limits through the state's rulemaking process. We try to do that every couple of years as we develop a new set of health-based values. We initiate rulemaking and then take those through the rulemaking process. So the values are identical in terms of the numeric numbers. They're developed with the same process. Just one has gone through rulemaking and one has not.
Okay. Representative Claflin.
Mr. Kelly, is there any difference in the enforceability of those values?
Mr. Kelly.
Mr. Chair, Representative, in some ways that's a question better posed to my colleagues at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. From the health department standpoint, they're guidance values. They're not enforceable per se under the Groundwater Protection Act. It's how those values are used by our colleagues who enforce the state's environmental regulations that determine whether one is of more value than another. And there are some cases where there is a value to having it be promulgated through rule versus simply being a guidance value.
Thank you.
Further questions? I do have one going back to the human possible links. First of all, on reproductive effects that you mentioned, decreased fertility, how dramatic is that? Is it something across the population as a whole? Can you talk a little bit more about that, please, Mr. Kelly?
Mr. Chairman, there's been some studies that have suggested, yes, a decrease in fertility, or more likely a lower birth weights that, you know, were some felt were associated with these particular chemicals or exposure to these chemicals in utero. That is still very much kind of up in the air. I don't know that that's been conclusively demonstrated. When we did an analysis of our East Metro populations that were been exposed to these chemicals in their water supplies, we didn't see any evidence of lower birth weight across the population or anything else unusual going on in those instances. So I think that's still a very active area of study. When we talk about very slight differences in birth weight, for instance, or even changes in fertility, they're very, very hard to measure across populations over time because there's all sorts of factors from economic to biological that can have an impact on those things.
Okay. And then the final question I have is on the vaccination response. You had mentioned that there was a decrease in the effectiveness of the vaccinations. Was there any correlation found between that and, say, negative side effects that people see from correlations? Was there anything that tied in that could be traced to this? Mr. Kelly.
Mr. Chairman, no, there was not evidence of subsequent impacts to those populations, and the decrease in the effectiveness of the vaccines may not necessarily have caused additional cases of the disease that the vaccine was intended to prevent. It simply showed that it was slightly less effective than they thought it would have been otherwise.
Okay. All right, thank you. I don't think there's any further questions. Thank you so much, Mr. Kelly. And now we are on to Ms. Neuschler. Did I pronounce that right?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome.
So we're going to talk a little bit about PFAS in Minnesota and our environmental and source investigation. I'm going to talk about environmental monitoring, and then my colleague Jamie Waller said is going to come up and talk a little bit about sources and conduits of PFAS. I think we generally covered how our understanding of PFAS has really changed, so I'm just going to skip to what we've been looking at in terms of groundwater and surface water impacts. We operate at the Pollution Control Agency an ambient groundwater network of about 270 wells designed to look at shallow wells, primarily not drinking water wells, but to give us a sense of what's in our groundwater. We sampled that entire network for PFAS compounds in 2013 with some limited follow-up on some of the higher wells in 2017. In 2013, 70% of our tested wells contained some kind of PFAS compound, and there were some exceedances of what we now know to be I guess, better, more scientifically defensible health-based values. In the cases where we did do follow-up between 2013 and 2017, we did generally see concentrations decline in those wells. And this past season in 2019, we went through and we've resampled our entire network again for PFAS chemicals. And we can now detect 33 of these chemicals. In 2013, we could only detect 13. There were only analytical methods for 13. So we're waiting to see what the results are when those samples come back from the lab where they're being analyzed. In terms of surface water, as you probably know, you know, we want our waters in Minnesota to be clean enough to support healthy aquatic life, to have fish that are safe for people to eat, and to be clean enough for people to recreate in safely. Mm. And obviously, levels of pollution can impact our ability to do any of these things. Our concern with PFAS, and particularly the PFOS, has been the levels in water bioaccumulating in the fish and leading to levels of fish that are unsafe for people to consume or to consume in the quantities that they would like to. And so we are looking at that and doing some sampling. In general, fish consumption is one of the major pathways of exposure to PFOS, along with drinking water for people. And so we've been looking at that. In terms of water bodies, we have 10 water bodies in Minnesota that are what we call impaired for aquatic consumption for these PFOS chemicals, because it means people can't eat unlimited amounts of fish. So we are looking at revising and developing what we call a site-specific criteria in PFOS for PFOS in fish tissue, and so that is a level of the chemical in fish tissue that is safe for people to consume. We have a couple of site-specific values right now in Pool 2 of the Mississippi River and also in Bede-Makaska, and we're looking at revising those, which I'll talk a little bit about more.
We could pause here. I believe Representative Torkelson has a question.
Sure.
So I'm just full of questions today. Is there a correlation between PFAS bioaccumulation and mercury bioaccumulation?
Ms. Neusler.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I mean, the concept is the same in terms of how the fact that the pollutant, you know, accumulates through the food chain. We see a little difference in general. The fish that have higher levels of mercury are the bigger top predator fish, and the fish that have higher levels of the PFAS chemicals tend to be more of the panfish. So it's something different is happening there in terms of how that bioaccumulation is sort of working in getting pollutants into the fish.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Fair. And geographically, I would assume mercury is everywhere and these chemicals are more concentrated and geographically.
Ms. Neusler.
Mr. Chair, you know, I think, and maybe I'll just kind of flip to where we've started to look at fish tissue data. I think really the PFAS chemicals are pretty widely distributed. I mean, I think as Jim was saying, we sort of thought originally these chemicals were really showing up in areas of disposal or direct sources. And now, you know, we do see them everywhere, maybe at different levels, but they are across the board.
So. Representative Torkelson, any? Okay. Ms. Neusler, please go ahead and continue.
So because one of our key concerns and one of our focuses is protecting human health from exposure to the PFAS in fish tissue, we've done a lot of work over time gathering data on levels of PFAS in water and PFAS in fish tissue. And so this is a slide of some places where we did gathering of fish tissue data, particularly from 2004 to 2012. Earliest collections looking at where the 3M cottage grove plant discharges wastewater, doing some targeted sampling sites where we thought we might have sources or conduits of the PFAS chemicals, but really looking across the board. And the colors are just different years of sampling. They don't mean anything in terms of results. But by 2012, we had data from 155 lakes and 8 rivers around the state for over 6,000 fish. And we did do, you know, as Representative Torkelson raised the question about where is this happening, we did do a lot of the fish sampling in the metro area because a lot of this was happening sort of in context with the East metro area. But I think, you know, after that time period, you know, as Jim spoke about, we really have an improved understanding of PFAS, and we've clarified really that these chemicals are more harmful to human health at levels lower than we previously thought. EPA had issued the health advisory, its MDH had changed the drinking water values and fish, and also their fish consumption advice thresholds in terms of how many, what level of pollutant is safe for how many meals per week or meals per month of fish. And at that point, then, as all this was happening, we really had mostly aging fish data. Most of our data of what was happening in fish was more than 5 years old. And so what we've been doing recently is going back and starting to sort of reinvigorate our fish sampling program through the Interagency Fish Contaminant Monitoring Program and different things that are happening at the PCA or also at MDH and in conjunction with our colleagues at DNR. So really in 2018, we went back to do a big survey of PFAS in fish and water. We looked at 70 water bodies and looked at fish and water for 13 PFAS chemicals, and as you can see, we really found PFAS everywhere. 95% of the waterways had at least one fish that had detectable PFAS levels, we had at least one PFAS chemical of the 13 detected in every sample of water. So we're using that data and working to continue to update our data collection. The Interagency Fish Contaminant Monitoring Program did some small sampling in 2019, and we plan at PCA to visit about 20 sites in 2020 to get more fish and water data, and also to include sediment, because there's some places where there's high levels in the fish but low levels in the water, so we want to understand what role sediment plays in that. We do see declining concentrations of the PFAS chemicals when we revisit sites, but we need to continue to follow up on that. So in terms of next steps and needs, what we're doing as Pollution Control Agency is using this data that we have, we are looking to identify what's the protective fish tissue concentration. And we've particularly been asked to do this for the East Metro area to be used in cleaning up the waters, particularly in Lake Elmo and in other areas of the East Metro. And so basically trying to figure out what's the level in fish tissue that's safe for people to be able to consume an unlimited amount of fish. And then what we do is we translate that using our water data and an understanding of bioaccumulation, we translate that to a water concentration. And so we'll be doing that for part of the East Metro area and then considering where else we may need this kind of protective value as part of our water programs, including potentially updating areas where we already have site-specific concentrations for PFAS that being pooled to Empedema costa. We're continuing to monitor fish tissue and water concentrations and add sediment testing, as I mentioned. We're planning to do 20 waters in 2020 and hopefully 30 to 40 sites in 2021, which is somewhat dependent on funding. Also to help us understand bioaccumulation. I think we have some understanding of it, but I think there's a lot more we could learn about how these chemicals move through the environment and get into the fish. And eventually in our water quality standards program, we need to determine then what need we have to promulgate a statewide water quality standard for PFAS and fish tissue, which would be similar to our statewide water quality standard for PFAS and mercury. I mean, it wouldn't be the same value, but would function in the same way. Also on the surface water side, we are currently in the early stages of updating our statewide water quality standards for drinking waters, both surface and groundwater, and are working with our colleagues at MDH to consider how we can incorporate MDH's health values, health-based values, or health risk limits into our water quality standards and our program, which would mean we would monitor and assess in all likelihood for those chemicals. We also want to evaluate the potential for risk to humans recreating in waters with higher levels of PFAS. In general, fish consumption, the level of PFAS that keeps the fish safe for consumption is going to be probably the most stringent level, the lowest number for the water bodies we're looking at. But we want to understand more about recreational risk, and particularly with the issue of the foam that we're finding in certain areas, which my colleague will talk more about. And I think over the long term, there's more to do to evaluate the PFAS risk to aquatic life and wildlife that drink from surface waters. We've really focused on what's happening with the fish as how the fish impact humans, rather than what impacts are PFAS chemicals having on the structure of the biological community itself. So that's probably much farther out in the future. So that's what I have about environmental monitoring.
Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mm-hmm. And thank you for the presentation. As you know, Katrina, I texted Commissioner Bishop on the 17th of January about these issues, and you followed up with my office quickly. I think the 24th, I received an email from you. And, you know, Mr. Chair, I think this is probably one of, if not the most important meetings you've called so far of this committee. This issue should probably have generated more conversation earlier, but I'm glad we're talking about it now. And it's not the fault of any one person. It's just an issue that we don't fully understand, right? And, you know, one of the questions that I had and that you worked to answer is one I still continue to kind of have some question marks relative to. Okay, we know 3M and their facilities were a producer of these chemicals, but we also know that our wastewater treatment facilities around the state are known to have these chemicals specifically in solids that are being field applied in some cases, is my understanding. If that's incorrect, you can correct the record. I guess what I'm driving at is, if we have known these chemicals to be as harmful as they seem to be known to be today, and we're pursuing lawsuits with companies like 3M, why is it that the state of Minnesota is not looking more closely at the solids that I mentioned that are being field applied by wastewater treatment facilities across the state of Minnesota? And then also, in some cases, I think some of those same permitted facilities are taking waters known to have these contaminants present and diluting and then discharging directly into the Mississippi, which is, of course, in some cases ahead of the drinking supply of Minneapolis and St. Paul. Like I said, I'm glad that we're recognizing that 3M had a part in this, but it seems like we're a little behind, or way behind potentially, when it comes to facilities around the state, and I'd be happy to hear if I've got my facts wrong.
Ms. Neuschler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Heintzman, in terms of the biosolids issue and the issue of the wastewater residuals that are spread, that's something we're very interested in learning more about, and actually a couple of my staff have prepared a proposal for the LCCMR process to do a big study to look at those and to understand, you know, how much of this is getting into the environment and how it's moving through. So that it's definitely an issue. It's an issue that people are discussing more and more nationwide. It's something that we really do want to look into and understand further. You know, in terms of the wastewater treatment plants and their direct effluent, I mean, I think we've really before, and I'm going to co-opt one of my coworker slides here, have been focused on this idea of sources, right? Who's directly generating and directly using PFAS in their processes or creating it? And putting it into the environment. And now I think we're thinking more and more about what we might call conduits, so the points where PFAS enters the environment, but they don't generate it. And I think the wastewater treatment plants would be kind of that conduit. You know, they're not, in general, probably not, they're not creating PFAS, there's probably not very much of it in their process, but they're this conduit and this pathway for where it enters the environment. But in terms of setting water quality standards and developing effluent limits and figuring out, you know, in order to set regulatory requirements, you know, we have to do that based on the best available science of what is needed. And that's really still developing. You know, I think Jim showed how much that's changed over time. And we're really just getting to the point with EPA doing advisories and other states doing drinking water guidance. I think the science has still been developing and is, I think, just now getting to a point where we really can start to think about what those things are we need on a regulatory basis to potentially deal with this on a broader scale than just the specifics of disposal and manufacturing.
Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To kind of get, I guess, more specific to my question, mm-hmm. We know that these chemicals are dangerous. 3M obviously was a part of that, and there's a lawsuit that's been moving and was settled here now a year and a half ago or so. If that being the case, why is it that we're not looking more closely at some of these other potential sources? And I get what you're saying, that they may not be creating the PFAS contaminant themselves, but they're permitted and they're being allowed to process contaminated waters in those facilities, and we're diluting and discharging directly into the Mississippi. That seems like a problem.
Ms. Neuschler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Heintzman, certainly that's something, you know, we're all concerned about, and we want to do some more, and I think Jamie's going to talk a little bit more about sources and some of our plans and ideas of where we want to look at sources, you know, and we would like to be able to do more monitoring of influent and effluent with wastewater treatment plants to understand that. So I hear you. It's things that we do really want to understand so that we can tackle this problem.
Okay. One of the questions before we move on, and I don't know if this will be part of the next presentation or not, is picking up a little bit. We know that it's quite pervasive out there, that it's coming through our wastewater plants. Is there any effective way for removing them, or what does it take to remove these chemicals as they're coming through the wastewater plants?
Mr. Chair, I think I'm going to defer most of that to my colleague here. Though I will note that for many of these kinds of chemicals, the volume of water going through effluent, a wastewater treatment plant is harder to deal with than, say, the volume happening in drinking water. So there's a kind of a question of scale there, but I'm going to turn it over to, I'm going to let Jamie handle that. I think she's going to talk about that a little bit.
Okay, very good. Ms. Wallerstedt, if you'd like to go ahead and try to take a swing at it, then you've got your part of the presentation to start with, too, I believe.
Thank you, Chair. There are different ways to remove PFAS from the water, but most of the treatment technologies out there are what we call separation treatment technologies, where we're just separating the PFAS from the water. We use granular activated carbon, which is a filter media that you can remove the PFAS from the water. There's also ion exchange, where, again, you can remove the PFAS from the water. The research out there has really started to develop on how we can, what we call destruction technologies, where we actually can destroy the PFAS, but those are not at this time ready for full-scale implementation. They're still in a research and development.
In terms of the two technologies you said that were currently available, are those ones that are currently being employed by waste treatment plants, or is it something that just does not fit in their scale? Or
yep, they have not, to my knowledge, that they have not been implemented in a wastewater treatment plant application. They are the technologies that are used in a drinking water treatment application.
Is that partly because of the fact of the volume that's coming through between the two different operations?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Okay. Mr. Kadelka.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Kirk Kadelka, Assistant Commissioner with the MPCA. We will have a discussion in a little bit, a slide about wastewater, and I think we can answer a lot of those questions at that time, if that's okay.
Okay, that'll be fine. We'll put a pause on that then. Okay, thank you. And
all right.
Ms. Wallerstedt,
yep.
You're on next here, correct, for your part?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, thank you very much. My name is Jamie Wallerstedt. I'm the manager of the site remediation section in the remediation division. That's where all the site assessment and Superfund sites, cleanup sites, are located. My coworker, Catherine Neuschler, took care of this slide, but what I'm here to talk about are some of the sources and conduits that we have identified in the Superfund program, so across the state of Minnesota, not just the East Metro. So what we have started to do at the MPCA is look at a PFAS source inventory, and we're doing this on a pilot scale, meaning that we started off in four counties looking at industrial sources in these four counties to determine if there's potential PFAS sources in these four counties. We started with St. Louis County, Stearns, Dakota, and Olmsted. And the reason we chose these four counties is, again, just to do it on a pilot scale to see if this is a feasible effort that we could push statewide. And these four counties have large metropolitan or population centers in them with different types of industries that we could take a look at. So the map on the left here is St. Louis County, and I'm putting it up here as an example of the results. And what this is what we did is we looked at the industrial types in these counties, and this is based on national research of the different types of industries that could have used PFAS, but it's really important to note that these industries may not have used PFAS as well. So it's just based on national research what types of industries have historically used PFAS across the country. And the types of industries, some of the example types of industries that we are looking at are airports, plating facilities, waterproofing industries, refineries where they're using firefighting foam, commercial printing and paper mills, and then also landfills and disposal facilities. And again, this is based on national research of where people have found PFAS in these industries. And what we're using the protocol for is to prioritize our sampling in our site assessment and Superfund programs. to see if drinking water or surface water sampling is warranted in these areas. So what we're doing next with this pilot study protocol, we would really like to validate the protocol with known historical release sites to determine whether we can use this protocol, possibly push it out statewide if it's proven to be useful. And we're looking at sampling 10 sites near industries to test this protocol. And we're still working on identifying which 10 sites we're going to be sampling this spring and summer. So just to go through some examples of these different types of industries, the first one I wanted to go through was fire training, airports and fire training facilities. In 2009, the MPCA did a study to evaluate airports and fire training facilities. What we did is we sent out a survey to fire chiefs and airport operators to identify where they were using firefighting foam in their operations. And based on those survey results, in 2009, we really relied on them to respond to the survey as to where they were using firefighting foam. And these sites on the left-hand side are all the facilities that responded to the survey. And what we did then was evaluated and did additional investigations at some of these sites where they reported that they did use a triple firefighting foam with perfluorinated compounds in them. And this is really how we found risks at a couple of sites, one being the airport in Bemidji site, which I'll go through next. And then this is also how we found the Duluth Air National Guard site, which I'll also go through as well. But a lot of these sites, we did not find PFAS at it, nor did we find a risk to drinking water. So the first one, airport, that we found was the Bemidji Airport. And I'm sure some of you probably are familiar with this site because it's being talked about this year, I think, in session. But PFAS was detected in Bemidji's municipal drinking water supply in 2014. So the map on the left, the purple area is the airport area or the airport site. And then that blue line is where the city's municipal drinking water wells are located. And what happened was, as the airport was using firefighting foam to train and then also respond to incidents, that contaminated their wells that are right on the airport site. So the source of the PFAS in this instance is that firefighting foam. And what's happening next is that the city is planning a drinking water treatment plant to be installed on the municipal water supply. And then also we're looking at additional PFAS investigations to identify how far the PFAS has spread off-site. The next sites are Department of Defense sites, so Duluth Air National Guard. PFAS was first detected in 2008. And then we found PFAS in drinking water wells and fish tissue in 2010. Again, the source of the PFAS is firefighting foam. And the Air National Guard is conducting additional investigations to identify potential cleanup actions. And treatment is installed on the two wells that are impacted at this site. Additionally, I just wanted to note, too, that the Army National Guard is beginning investigations at St. Cloud, St. Paul, and Camp Ripley as well. So they're going to start to look at PFAS as well at their sites. An example of manufacturing sites is when PFAS is used in an industrial process. PFAS was detected in Bede-Makaska in 2004, and the MPCA then traced the PFAS detections in Bede-Makaska through the stormwater back to an industrial plating facility in St. Louis Park. So if you see off to the left, the small purple area, that is the site of the PFAS contamination, and it's known as Douglas Corporation, that impacted Bede-Makaska and ultimately a fish consumption advisory out there. The PFAS source is a mist suppressant used during the industrial operations to keep it safe for their workers. Douglas Corporation was asked to stop the PFAS release immediately, which they have done, and the company is now required to investigate how far PFAS has gone off-site and in the groundwater. So they're doing further investigations at that site. The 3M disposal facilities, I think you're all familiar with this, and I'm trying to save on time. But the one thing I did want to mention here is the concentrations that we're finding in these disposal facilities in the East Metro are a lot higher than what we're finding across the state. So these disposal facilities had very concentrated 3M disposal, and so that's why we're seeing it so widespread in the East Metro. Another I would call these conduits are these closed landfills. So the closed landfill program was formed in the 1990s, and the state is responsible for all long-term monitoring and maintenance at these sites. So all the maintenance and monitoring are by state funds in the closed landfill program. So the PFAS was detected in the closed landfill program beginning in 2012. And as you can see on the left-hand side are all 110 closed landfills that the state is responsible for, color-coded by exceedances of PFAS, detections, not detections, and then not analyzed. So far, we've analyzed for PFAS at 90 landfills, and we've detected it at 97% of them. And just one thing I wanted to note, with the exception of the Washington County landfill, which is a 3M disposal facility, all the other landfills have relatively low detections of PFAS. They're not comparable to the East Metro detections. And then one other note on this slide, we do have a couple of private wells that are impacted. We have treatment on all those four private wells right now. And then the latest news that we released in January of 2020, we have found PFAS in surface water foam. And surface water foam is that naturally occurring foam that happens on surface waters. You see it on lakes, you see it on streams. And in the East Metro on Raleigh Creek in Oakdale and Lake Elmo, where PFAS is known to be located in the surface water and in the groundwater, we have found high levels of PFAS concentrations in the surface water foam. We also have found it in Battle Creek, or on Battle Creek in St. Paul and Maplewood, and we're further testing the Battle Creek site to determine if we can find a source for that PFAS. And then just a quick note, two other sites have also detected PFAS in surface water foam, Michigan and Wisconsin, and we've been in contact with them as they've developed what their response actions are with regards to the foam.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I'm going to take it over from here just to talk about our solid waste, and we're going to talk about a number of different sources, my colleague Katrina and I, and also then wrap more into our larger efforts on PFAS overall. In our landfill leachate, we have found PFAS in leachate or land application sites where we have looked for it. Again, as noted earlier with our closed landfill sites, these are at much lower concentrations than what we find at the 3M disposal sites. However, they are high enough still to have concerns. And that includes groundwater monitoring at four of our leachate sites where we have found it over the health values. And a number of these landfills are in the process of moving forward with systems to address the issue. At these open landfills, the conduit is likely PFAS consumer products, and that's where we're looking to do more investigation to go upstream and start removing it. We'll talk a little bit in general about that overall. The other solid waste sites that we find it at are compost sites. We have known for a little while that we have been finding it at organic sites that deal with food waste. And recently, a 2019 study, we've also now found it at two yard waste sites that we examined. In both of these cases where we've looked for it, it is over at least one of the Minnesota Department of Health values for PFAS. Again, this is likely a conduit of the materials, consumer products going in there, such as food packaging and serviceware for compost sites, and potentially pesticides for the yard waste sites. We're looking to do additional investigation here, including tracking down and looking at upstream sources so that we can remove that, being the more efficient avenue. In general, when we look at solid waste, this has put a freeze on how we handle a number of these sites in place. For instance, if there's a site, whether it's a compost facility or an open landfill, that's looking to add application of leachate land application, we have frozen that, along with other technologies where we believe that might have a chance or a potential risk to move it to a different media.
Mr. Chair, I'm Katrina Kessler. I'm going to take it over from here. We're just going to quickly move through the rest. Another assistant commissioner at the MPCA. And directly in response to some of the discussion already, I'm going to cover the wastewater treatment and kind of next steps and work at the federal level. As you've heard from others, we've been working on this issue in different avenues for more than a decade and have really been seen by other states now who are ramping up their programs and as an example of how to learn how to do this, and that includes work at wastewater treatment plants. The first survey that was done was in 2007 and 2008 and included 80 wastewater treatment plants across the state, both municipal and industrial facilities in the Twin Cities metro area and outstate. The sampling included biosolid sampling at 40 facilities, and there were follow-up activities at those facilities where we saw high levels, including most prominently looking where we could minimize sources. So this gets back to what you've heard from others, that the most effective way and cost-effective way to deal with this is to minimize it upstream. And so that is the path that we have taken in the past, and that is the path that we are pursuing. But we recognize concerns, as our health department colleagues have noted, that we know more about risks now, and we know that we need to keep looking at sources, both at wastewater facilities, compost facilities, solid waste facilities, as well as the byproducts of wastewater facilities, including biosolids, and that is work that we are committed to doing going forward. You've heard some of the work that we have ongoing. You've heard about how we have increased our capacity at our state Minnesota Department of Health lab. That is a need that we see to continue to grow. It's different testing clean water, drinking water, wastewater, biosolids, compost, leachate, solid waste leachate, and we understand that dirty water methods are more complex and they need more refinement, and that is one of the needs that we have identified, and we plan to work on that, assuming that we have the resources to do that. We also understand that we need, again, to be vigilant about upstream sources, so looking at minimization, working with our partners, whether that be our municipal or an industrial wastewater partners or our landfill or compost facility partners, to understand sources so that we can mitigate and minimize this impact overall. And then the other risk, or the other area that we are working on to advance understanding, is air transport. We recognize that there are findings of these chemicals around the world in remote locations where they don't have a solid waste facility. There is not a manufacturing facility. And in those cases, it's likely that that chemical has carried through the air and been deposited. And we need to understand more about that pathway in Minnesota, and that's planned as well. So these actions on the screen are, we're moving ahead with a grant in concert with our colleagues at the Department of Health this year to advance some of this. And then I just want to make sure that we get to this, because this gets at some of the discussion that's already had. Ms. Neuschler mentioned that we have put in a $1.4 million request to the LCCMR, and this is directly in response to concerns that we have and others have related to how to provide the assistance to our municipal wastewater facilities, landfills, and composting facilities to understand fate and transport within water, solids, and then the byproducts. So specifically where we know that these wastes are being land applied, whether that's biosolids or composting or other byproducts, we want to make sure that we understand not only what's in the water, but how it moves potentially from the water to the soil, or from the biosolids or the compost to the soil. And then to your question, what is the take up of that within the plants? And then what is potential risk to animals or others who may consume that crop or those plants? And so that is an area where there is a gap in the science, and we want to continue to be leaders at the state level and across the country
And the LCCMR grant would help us understand directly what the risk is when you land apply biosolids or compost product, and then what the fade and transport is. It would also look at, and this was a question too, what are the off-the-shelf treatments that are available right now, and where can we provide help to people who need to treat right now? And I think this gets at some of the other questions that people have raised. And just so we understand the scope of this, biosolids are generated and land application is practiced by 137 facilities around the state, and this is 21% of all the biosolids that are generated in the state. So this is not a isolated facility challenge. This is a statewide challenge that we take seriously and we want to continue to move forward. And then briefly, because I know that we are near the end of our time or past our time, you've heard about work that's ongoing at the federal level, and you've heard our colleagues say that the federal level has not promulgated any enforceable drinking water standards. You've heard about the health-based values or the guidance values that they've put forward. You've heard that they are going to, through their uncontaminated or unregulated contaminants program, ask states around the country to do more monitoring at community drinking water supplies. Other work at the federal level includes action to require what's called the toxic release inventory reporting. So this is a publicly available database that includes information on chemical releases, and it's reported annually by industry groups and federal facilities. So large manufacturers or users of chemicals, including mining facilities, paper, oil and gas, or other large volume users of these. The other work that's ongoing is the EPA is writing rules under the Toxics Control Substance Act, or TOXCA, that requires reporting, record keeping, and testing of individual chemicals and mixtures. And we are actively working with the feds to understand how we can make sure that the work that Minnesota has done is reflected in that work. Other things that are ongoing, the USGS is required to do some national monitoring of lakes and streams, and the DOD is phasing out the use of aqueous firefighting foams by 2024 and testing blood in firefighters. And we are engaging directly with EPA and others where we can, and working with partner organization, or I'm just going to skip past this because I think we've covered that. We're working with these organizations on the slide, the Council of Environmental States, the Great Lakes PFAS Task Force. These are our Region 5 partners, as well as others who are looking at specifically where we have gaps, again, that air transport, risk to wildlife and fish, and biosolids and land application, some of the themes we've highlighted today, as well as the foam. We're also looking at working with the Association of Clean Water Administrators. So these are the wastewater treatment professionals around the state who are being challenged by the same challenges that we see here. And we want to make sure that our learning can benefit them, and that we can also understand what we can do better based on their activities. We previously, through the mid-2010 time range, had a very active what's called a PFAS lateral team. We worked with the Department of Health and others to understand how we can work collaboratively to advance our understanding of where the gaps are and how to allocate resources and identify priorities. And then in the 2016 time range, what's known as the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council really took up PFAS at the interstate level, and we then became really engaged in that activity. We actually have we're co-leaders with others on the PFAS the interstate at the national level of this group, as well as we have a number of staff that are engaged to understand how we can, again, be most efficient with our limited resources. But recognizing that we need a more focused.
And I had, could yeah, we, oh, yeah, about sure, two sure. more minutes and then.
Yep, this is the you. End. Okay, so good. Recognizing that we need a more focused and coordinated effort, again, to focus on Minnesota, we have reformed that PFAS lateral team. So this includes leadership, technical experts from the Department of Health, the MPCA, and DNR, and we're open to expanding that and looking at how we can leverage the work that we, the great breadth of work that we have done to date, as well as focus going forward. And the initial work through this coming summer will be focused on communicating risks, understanding presence and ways to mitigate and minimize sources, as well as kind of coalescing our understanding around risk-based values. And the MPCA is hiring a full-time coordinator to lead this effort. So we will be working through the first half of 2020 to identify gaps, and we'll be sharing the learning broadly, because communication is part of this. As we've all talked about, this really is a ubiquitous challenge, and making sure that we can inform appropriations asks and a focus going forward as efficiently as possible.
Awesome. Thank you. Quite a bit. We did run over a little bit on this issue here. We went about 15 minutes long. Unless somebody has any quick questions, I want to thank everyone for coming and doing the presentation here. Quite informative. And if we could then move on to the next part, which is going to be addressing E. coli and beach monitoring. This is an issue that I had seen come up this past summer in the metro area here, where a number of lakes were being hit with E. coli contamination. These were lakes that did not have the problem in the past. So we're finding out that with the climate change that's occurring, this is something that's going to be becoming more of an issue as we go forward. So we've got about 15 minutes left. So we will start off, and I believe we have Ms. Robinson from the Minnesota Department of Health.
Correct, thank you.
Okay, if you'd like to introduce yourself, and then we can get, and I know that going to have to switch the presentation around here. And we do have the, in our packets, we do have the data presentation here, so we could also have, if everyone could grab that, and we could even get started in that area then as it pops up.
Thank you for having me. My name is Tricia Robinson, and I'm the supervisor of the Waterborne Diseases Unit at the Minnesota.
Excuse me, can you draw the microphone a little bit closer to you, please?
Sure thing.
Thank you.
Is that better?
You might have to get right on top of it. It's
everybody's taller than I am. Perfect. Is that better? No?
A little bit, yeah.
Okay. And I'm the supervisor of the Waterborne Diseases Unit at the Minnesota Department of Health. So given how much E. coli and beach monitoring and beach closures were in the news last summer, it's no big surprise that a lot of people are asking kind of all, what does this mean for the land of 10,000 lakes, where we all value our great swimmable waters that we have here. In the Waterborne Diseases Unit at the Minnesota Department of Health, we conduct surveillance for reportable waterborne pathogens, we conduct disease outbreak investigations, and we conduct studies on waterborne illness. We use this information that we get to provide education and outreach to not only keep our citizens and visitors healthy, but also keep our water healthy for everyone to enjoy. Swimmers can get a variety of waterborne illnesses in lakes, but the most common are infections that cause diarrhea, like Cryptosporidium, Giardia, E. coli, Shigella, or norovirus. Naegleria fowleri might be something you're less familiar with. It is often referred to as the brain-eating amoeba. But it causes a very rare but almost always deadly brain infection called primary amoebic meningoencephalitis, or PAM for short. We have had two cases in Minnesota, both of which were caused at the same lake in Stillwater. Harmful algal blooms, something that often looks like spilled green paint or pea soup, is something that can also cause illness in our lakes. And that can cause kind of multiple symptoms for people, something like respiratory symptoms or diarrhea or rash, kind of a number of different manifestations. So kind of when we talk about diarrheal illnesses, since they're the most common and kind of the ones that hit the news a lot, we often get the question of like, well, how would you get a diarrheal illness if we're off swimming in the water? And how do they even get in the water? Well, the truth of the matter is everybody has kind of fecal material on their bottom at any given time. And that's really gross to think about, but that's the truth. So we all, everybody, has about 0.14 grams of feces on their bottom at any given time. And if we don't know what that is, because who knows what 0.14 grams is, it's about the size of a Nerd candy, and that's what's pictured here. If you're a Nerds candy lover, I apologize. It may not be your favorite candy after this. But you can see that, you know, they kind of all come in all different colors and sizes, and that's kind of like all the different swimmers that are entering the water. And so when somebody that is ill with diarrhea enters the water, that amount of fecal material contains millions of germs and it's washing off into the water. And then everybody else that's swimming in that water is unintentionally swallowing the water. It's not like we're going in the water wishing to drink the water. It's just that we unintentionally swallow the water. And with that, we unintentionally swallow up everybody else's germs that went in the water with their NERDS. So along with kind of all of that other stuff that I talked about that we cover in our waterborne diseases unit, we also cover the Lake Superior Beach Monitoring Program. As part of this program, we monitor 38 beaches along Lake Superior. It is the only beach monitoring program that is conducted by the Minnesota Department of Health. It is conducted as part of the National Beach Act, which is federally funded. So a little bit about beach monitoring in Minnesota. It is at the discretion of the entity that is responsible for the beach. This might be the city, the county, the park district. Basically, whoever owns the beach gets to decide what is done with it as far as beach monitoring. This includes the frequency of monitoring and the criteria that is used for issuing an advisory. The goal of beach monitoring is to help determine if the beach water is safe for recreational activities and to minimize the risk of people getting sick. When we go out and do beach monitoring, basically a small water sample is collected at the beach. The results are available the next day, and an advisory is then issued and the beach is closed if the E. coli levels are too high. The beach will reopen then when the E. coli levels are acceptable. So what exactly is E. coli in water when we're talking about at the beach? So it's a sign that there could be fecal contamination in the water that could be, make people sick. It is found in both humans and animals. But when we talk about it, we need to understand that there are hundreds of different kinds of E. coli out there that could be found in lakes that do not make people sick. There are simply just a handful that are actually capable of making people sick. And when we test for E. coli, we're testing for all of the different kinds that are out there, the ones that would not make people sick and the ones that could make people sick. High levels of E. coli indicate that germs that could make people sick might be in the water. It does not mean that those germs are in the water and people are going to get sick. It is simply the indication that it could be there. Beach monitoring is far from a perfect science, though. But unfortunately, it's the best science that we have available to us right now. But it is unlikely to detect the ill swimmer that enters the water. And so that is exactly the case like in Lake Nokomis last summer. That was a pathogenic E. coli. So that's one of the few E. coli that really we worry about and that can make people sick. And unfortunately, in that outbreak, we had 69 people that we identified that did get sick. And in that outbreak, one in four people that we interviewed that were a result of this outbreak, which included both the people that work at the beach and the people that were swimming there, reported that they continued to swim while they were sick with diarrhea. It goes to the case in point of, you know, the NERDS that are on us. If we're sick with germs and we're getting in that water, while we have something that we can spread to everybody else that we're swimming with, we can make it everybody else sick too. Similarly, we had a large outbreak at Lake Minnetonka in the Big Island area over the 4th of July holiday, where 198 people became sick with a viral illness. But this is why it's so important that we provide education and outreach to all of our swimmers, regardless of whether they are at a beach that is monitored or not. We talk about how they can stay healthy at the beach, and also how they can keep the beach healthy for everyone else who is enjoying it. We put out these messages to the public on our website, through our social media channels, and through the media and local partners. So when we talk about being at the beach, we talk about how we can minimize the risk of our illness, but then we also talk about how we can keep it healthy for everyone else. So when we talk about for ourselves, we talk about not swallowing the water. We talk about showering after swimming for ourselves. We talk about avoiding swimming after a heavy rain event, since that can allow all of the contaminants that are around the lake to wash right in. Avoid swimming at beaches where you can see discharge pipes. They do exist, as much as we wouldn't like to think about that. There are many beaches out there that have discharge pipes at them. And avoid swimming if you see a blue-green algal bloom. We don't know that it would have a toxin that could make people sick, but we use kind of the little quip, if in doubt, best keep out. But then kind of what can we do to help keep the water healthy for everyone else out there? Well, most importantly, stay out of the water if you have diarrhea. This seems kind of like a no-brainer, but as our Lake Nokomis outbreak illustrated, people don't stay out of the water if they are sick. And we need to do a better job of making sure that everybody understands that kind of we all play a role in keeping the water healthy, and that we all share the water and the germs in it with everyone else who's out there. That we shower before we go swimming for everyone else to help wash off all of the germs that are on us so that they don't go in the water with us. That we take frequent bathroom breaks, especially if we're swimming with young children. Waiting to hear someone say, I have to go to the bathroom, is often really kind of too late. That we change diapers frequently and away from the water. That we dispose of trash properly, including boat waste. Improper boat waste disposal can often lead to large issues, as could potentially have even been the cause of our Lake Minnetonka outbreak. That we maintain septic systems, and that don't encourage waterfowl by feeding ducks, geese, or other birds. Changing climate conditions are a reality, as much as things like Naegleria fowleri, or the brain-eating amoeba that I mentioned earlier, that thrives in warm conditions. And kind of the dog days of summer are where we would see it be a greater risk as temperatures rise and water levels lower. And things like harmful algal blooms also. They are a reality in Minnesota lakes. In Minnesota, we have no centralized location for beach monitoring results. Additionally, we have no centralized location for alerts in place at a beach, such as a pollution spill or if there was a harmful algal bloom that had been noted. And there is no system for evaluating monitoring results to determine best practices. As I mentioned earlier, that it is at the discretion of whoever is responsible for the beach, including the frequency and the criteria that are used. And with that, I am happy to answer any questions if anybody has.
Okay, I've got a couple of questions. I noticed on slide 12 you're mentioning avoid swimming after a rain event. Is that telling me that there's a lot that comes down through the storm sewer systems that we have in place throughout the metro area? Is that one of the contributing sources?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, so kind of following a heavy rain event, kind of everything that is around the water has the potential to wash into the water with it. So that could be through our storm system. It could be kind of in the surrounding area. And you know, even just in the perimeter right around the beach. And so we kind of, there are varying opinions on this. Some say following 24 hours, some say 48 hours following a heavy rain event that we would avoid swimming. And we kind of use that at the discretion of people that we would say heavy rain because people don't often check, you know, to say like, is it an inch, is it 2 inches? And so we would say a heavy rain so that everything can kind of, you know, dilution is the solution to pollution, especially when we talk about like our swimming beaches area. So we need to allow it to kind of disperse the area.
Okay. And then also I noticed that you'd mentioned climate change because I noticed that in terms of the number of lakes that we had this past year were quite a bit more than I've seen in the past. So is this a trend that we're probably going to be seeing more of? And also on top of that, the question comes in is, no, this is only a limited number of lakes that we're seeing testing done in the metro area because they're the ones with swimming beaches at certain levels that the beaches decide to test. So is the problem a lot bigger than we are seeing just at the swimming beaches?
So, Mr. Chairman, with there be no statewide centralized system to this, I can't tell you what the trends are. There isn't a way in which we can tell you that at this point. There is no way in which that is monitored right now. With climate change, you know, with their potential for heavier rains, other conditions, that certainly is a possibility, but I can't speculate and I don't know what the data, you know, would tell us. The only data that we have is based on our Lake Superior Monitoring Program. Those numbers certainly have increased in recent years. However, you know, our summer of 2019, was actually we had lower advisories in 19 than we have had in the last 5 years. So that was kind of an anomaly. But Lake Superior is a very different body of water than our inland beaches, particularly here in the metro area. Also, you know, beach monitoring and whether it is done, we have many monitored beaches here in the Twin Cities metro area, but that is certainly not the case when you look at greater Minnesota.
Thank you. I see we're up at the end of our time for today. I want to thank you, Ms. Robinson, for coming in today to present to us, and we will stand adjourned. Thank you all.